and welcome to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate the overlooked, ignored, derided, or the just plain hated. Movies, novels, music, comic books, video games, whatever. If everyone hates it, we'll find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston, and my guest today is the technologist Michael Palmer. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, tell us what you have come on the show to talk about. Give us some context around its release, its reception, why it is maligned, and why you think that that is wrong.
I've come to talk about the 1986 John Carpenter classic Big Trouble in Little China. What Big Trouble aims to do was a fusion of the kind of American Western inside the martial arts genre and a reintroduction of a kind of John Wayne archetype character through Kurt Russell, who I think plays the part beautifully. And what we see is him serving as this trucker that gets kind of thrown into San Francisco's Chinatown in this underground mix of Chinese mythology and martial arts exploitation that's there. However, you know, as much as I've grown to love this over the years, seeing it as a child and then just continuing to watch it, I think I'm up to maybe 80, 90 times.
Wow.
What ends up really kind of making it unjustly maligned is kind of the background story to it. This is actually the movie that drives John Carpenter out of Hollywood and really cements his place in the kind of independent film scene, which is what he was really known for, you know, coming out with, you know, Assault on Precinct 13, Halloween, both serving as independent movies, and then coming off after Big Trouble and then doing great shows and films like They Live afterwards. But there was such a conflict between kind of John Carpenter's vision of what he wanted this to be as this kind of modern reinduction of this John Wayne archetype, which no longer fit, and his kind of interpretation of that character with what the studio wanted to do. So the studio actually wanted this to be this kind of big epic, and they were actually talking about Big Trouble being the biggest movie of the year in 1986. the problem was is that's also the year that Top Gun came out, and I think the stat is you know, Big Trouble costs about $20 billion or $20 million to make, and I kind of want to see the $20 billion John Carpenter movie.
Yeah, I'd love to see that.
Of course, again, starring Kurt Russell. And I assume that'll just be an amalgam of The Thing, Big Trouble, They Live, and Escape from L.A., not New York. But what it was about $20 million budget, and it only made about $11 million in the box office. It was a very rushed movie because this is actually has a sister movie to it in the Golden Child starring Annie Murphy. So the studio kind of knew a similar theme movie of this kind of American outsider in a Far East Asian mythological dynamic would end up being huge competition for the movie. So they really rushed it to get out, and there are some production problems. And then the studio also thought that American audiences wouldn't understand John Carpenter's overall vision for the character, which is where you get some confusion of, if you watch it, who the actual hero is. Is it Jack Burton? Is it Wang? Who is the lead? And John Carpenter and Kurt Russell actually say that Kurt Russell's character, Jack Burton, isn't the hero. He's actually the buffoon.
This is Jack Burton in the Pork Chop Express, and I'm talking to whoever's listening out there. Like I told my last wife, I says, honey, I never drive faster than I can see. Besides that, it's all in the reflexes. Listen to the old Pork Chop Express and take his advice on a dark and stormy night, all right? When some wild-eyed, 8-foot-tall maniac grabs your neck, taps the back of your favorite head up against a barroom wall, and he looks you crooked in the eye and he asks you if you've paid your dues, well, you just stare that big sucker right back in the eye, and you remember what old Jack Burton always says at a time like that. Have you paid your dues, Jack? Yes, sir, the check is in the mail.
Absolutely right. He is the lead, no question, but there's no way that he's the hero in this movie. That's Wang.
Yeah, Wang is clearly the, and it's so obvious once you start watching through when, You know, there's a scene where they're escaping from the Wing Kong trading exchange for the first time. Mm-hmm. And they get trapped in a room with kind of the standard martial arts axe gang breaking through. And Jack Burton, you know, shoots a couple of them and then tries to get his boot knife out and ends up throwing it across the room. And Wang basically ends up clearing the room before he even finds the knife.
Right, by the time he's got the knife back, Wang's just dealt with them all, hasn't he?
Yeah, and he just and Wang's just kind of like, oh, let's just go on. And yeah. There's all these instances of Jack Burton where it's clearly that he's not the kind of guy that he presents himself as, and he's really kind of the outsider in this place. And if you look at the movie from Jack Burton's perspective, and see it as like, this is a guy entering this world for the first time, it becomes this kind of whole new experience.
Mutual Fidelity Insurers of Sacramento. Yeah, well, there's gotta be a listing, honey. I pay him $6,000 a year in premiums.
China is here, Mr. Burton.
Yeah, go ahead. All right.
The Chan Xing.
Yeah, okay.
The Wing Kong. They've been fighting for centuries.
What does that mean? Huh? China is here? I don't even know what the hell that means. All I know is this Lo Pan character comes out of thin air in the middle of a goddamn alley while his buddies are flying around on wires cutting everybody to shreds, and he just stands there waiting for me to drive my truck straight through him with light coming out of his mouth. Jack, please.
So, like, my favorite story of the, like, studio interference is the alleyway fight scene. They have the Chang Sing having their funeral come through the alleyway where they end mm-hmm. up driving through, and the Wing Kong are coming down to fight them. So you're supposed to have the bad guys in the red turbans and the good guys in the yellow turbans. John Carpenter wanted it so that you didn't know who was the good guy and who was the bad guy in that situation, because kind of making a critique that, you know, Jack Burton couldn't really tell the difference between them.
Right.
And the studio actually made Wang come back in and overdub literally a line that says, like,
Wang, these guys, these Sing Dings.
Chang Sings.
They got enemies?
Wing Kong.
Who wear red turbans.
Holy shit. These guys are animals, Jack.
And John Carpenter, I think, like, loves to point out, it's like, yeah, because watching one group that's dressed all in black isn't enough to tell that they're bad against the group that's dressed entirely in white as the good guys.
Well, and not to mention that the guys dressed in black literally fire semi-automatic machine guns at the coffin that the guys in white are carrying. I mean, isn't that enough of a clue?
I don't understand where it is of, like, first off, where these guys are coming out with, like, AK-47s in 1980s San Francisco
yeah.
just to shoot up a coffin and the guys sign. And, like, to me, that seems what their main focus is like, if we're going to do anything, we're just messing up this coffin and the sign. We don't care if anybody else gets hurt, because that's who they're aiming for. And it's not until the three storms come in that the Chang-Chi, actually, the good guys, actually start taking some casualties.
Right, yeah.
So I just think that this movie has been messed up in its initial release, and now that it's kind of out, you know, almost, it would actually be this summer, it would be 30 years out, it allows us to kind of look at it from a very different perspective. Now, on a personal note, I actually grew up in St. Louis and still live there today. And so there's a weird hidden dynamic in St. Louis of there's a certain group of kind of like film enthusiasts where you just love John Carpenter because right. Escape from New York is filmed here. And
of course, yeah, yeah.
So my hometown is right next to East St. Louis, and East St. Louis was supposed to be the equivalent of what they saw as New York bombed out by a nuclear holocaust.
Yeah.
And we have a massive, it's been rehabilitated now, but it's a Union Station was this massive train station, is where they actually filmed the boxing match mm-hmm. with Steak Plissken. So we actually have this kind of like deep love for John Carpenter going through. And my first experience with Big Trouble was I grew up in a family that really loved the kind of John Wayne Western, and it just wasn't my thing. It was a generational gap. As a kid in the 80s, the Western didn't really fit. But dear Lord, I love Kung Fu movies like nobody's right. business. And my aunt actually owned a video rental store before the days of Blockbuster. And so we would get this big cycle, and I specifically remember that one of the standees was the classic Kurt Russell as Jack Burton holding the semi-automatic pistol with all this great stuff happening in the background. And I became enamored with the standee before I saw the movie. And I remember it was a Thanksgiving and they were running it on TV. And I was able to sit down with my uncles and my grandfather, and they were able to see kind of Jack Burton as a John Wayne. I was able to see the Kung Fu. So it was kind of this point of like me officially becoming a man in the family because this like last barrier of not liking Westerns was kind of conquered, but I liked it in my own specific way. So I have a 4-year-old and a 1-year-old now, and they've actually watched it with me. I quote Jack Burton to them numerous times, and it's kind of our little wink-wink with each other. It's just this nice kind of family tradition that's emerged now from it. And you just got to love the fact that you can pass on to your children. Like, it's all in the reflexes.
Yeah. Well, and it is just such a fun movie. I saw it when I was quite young. I think I don't think I saw it at the cinema, but I saw it, I think, as soon as it came out on video from the local video store. And then many, many, many times again since. Like you, I don't think I've gone 80 or 90, but I've watched it many, many times. It is kind of like a Western. You can see that actually, I think more so, it's more like a Western at the start and more like a sort of Hong Kong Kung Fu action movie at the end. The standoff that you're talking about with the between the Chang Sings and the Wing Kong, that is, before it starts, you even get a guy come out, one of the Wing Kong comes out with dual pistols on his hips and, you know, stands there wiggling his hands as if he's about to draw pistols before they all pull out semi-automatic machine guns. You get that Leone style, you know, focus on people's eyes and everybody's standing there staring at one another. It is very Western, that part. And as you say, Jack Burton's character is this kind of laconic gunslinging type, except of course he doesn't have any experience as a gunslinger, which they even hang a lantern on halfway through the first time he shoots somebody. And Wang's partner actually says to him, you know, first time you plugged somebody, and he's like, of course not.
Yeah, he comes off as this character because he has the opening is, I really think, iconic of that, you know, a lone, you know, desperado sheriff kind of like rolling into town, but instead of horses, it's a semi-truck, right?
And a truck, yeah.
Of the Pork Chop Express, and it's even the same thing in kind of the standoff idea. I just love that guy with the six shooters, and he has bandoleros on him as well. And the original script was actually for it to be, you know, set in 1800s as a Western.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And so, when Carpenter came on board, he actually pointed out that, you know, this would never fly. You know, there's always these kind of reattempts to reinvigorate the Western in American film since like the 1970s. And we've never really been able to get it. And I think Carpenter kind of saw that it was a dead genre that needs reimagining. So you can take those same kind of principles to kind of standoff. But and that was a point of contention. I think it was W.D. Richter, I think, was the author of the original script and really was kind of pushing for that idea. But John Carpenter said that it didn't work. Kurt Russell wasn't necessarily the first choice to be Jack Burton, but there was other actors and basically everybody that came through the production side of it that was going to be on screen or filming it was pointing out that, no, this isn't going to work as a Western. We need to really juice it up into the modern day. And I think that you just get those great subtleties put into it. And I think even Egg Shen makes some references to the West when they reference him, and he kind of talks about the history of Chinatown really briefly
and the gold rush.
And all that money was used to, you know, sent home and then brought over to build out Chinatown. So they kind of have these visual connections and these thematic connections, but they also kind of root that, you know, Chinatown is built on the West and this idea of the American West.
Man, I can't even imagine anybody other than Kurt Russell playing Jack Burton, because I'm sure part of this comes out of his long-standing relationship with John Carpenter. And incidentally, if anybody has a DVD of pretty much any Carpenter Russell movie, listen to the commentary. They are great in commentary because they are just clearly very, very old friends having a beer, having a laugh, you know, just reminiscing and waxing nostalgic about this good time they had making this movie. It's really, really fun. So some of it probably comes out because of their long-standing friendship, but there's something about Russell's performance in this that is really kind of underrated. You know, he is a buffoon, but he plays the character not knowing he's a buffoon, and he is smart. You know, he does have some smarts and he has some good ideas, and there's all these sort of conflicting things going on in the character, and Russell doesn't push any of them too far. You know what I mean? I think it would be very easy with this character to push one aspect of the character too far and, you know, be too buffoon-like, or be too macho, or be too swaggering, or be too comic relief. And he manages to get them all, get the balance just right, I think.
Yeah, this is like the time in the 80s of like the kind of mega, you know, Sylvester Stallone, Arnold Schwarzenegger, macho machismo action star. And I think that Kurt Russell, you know, in his comedic roles is good at kind of adding that kind of like action star swagger to it. And in a lot of his action roles, he even has that kind of like dry wit.
Right. Even Snake Plissken has a sense of humor.
Yeah. And I'm thinking even in like the thing of the, you know, he's playing chess against the computer. The computer, you know, he claims the computer cheats against them in chess and the thing. And he just pours his drink into the computer. And I mean, you know, the entire camp in Antarctica is about to be torn apart by alien presence. And it's great having these kind of like little subtle moments in it. And I think it might be on the DVD commentary for Big Trouble where they actually talk about favorite performances, and John Carpenter actually says that his favorite performance from Kurt Russell is Captain Ron, and his second is Big Trouble. And I think that speaks that he's this guy that's able to kind of exist in both worlds of being a comedic actor and stuff like Used Cars, which is very, very... has that comedic presence to it and is very overtly comic, but he still has some subtlety. And again, like another one of those weird references when he goes into the White Tiger to go and find Meow for the first time, and they go into kind of the brothel. He's dressed in his suit from Used Cars, and so there's all.
Oh, is it the same suit?
It's the exact same suit. So it's like they're building this kind of universe of Kurt Russell in the area. But I completely agree with you that he strikes this nice balance, kind of in the final battle sequence. I think he only ends up, spoilers of that he kills Lo Pan, but he ends up only in the kind of big fight sequence. Egg Shen is throwing these kind of jewel hand grenades, and Wang is literally like running up walls and flying through the air as sword fighting.
Doing wuxia wire work and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, and Kurt Russell is, you know, Jack Burton does the kind of standard yeehaw of holding his gun up in the air and shooting, and he ends up, being knocked out for about the first half of the fight.
Right, he shoots out the ceiling, the rock lands on his head, and it knocks him unconscious for the start of the big fight. I love that.
Yeah, and I still love his, there's like a demon guard or something that comes to him, and he pushes the knife through his boot and ends up, you know, stabbing the guy, which is a pretty cool action star way of kind of fighting this battle, but he gets stuck with the guy on top of him.
Right, the guy falls on top and he can't get him off, he's too heavy.
it's like one of those things of like every time he has this chance to kind of be that hero and kind of take the spotlight from Wang, there's just always something that throws a monkey wrench into it.
Right. Well, and this is why I don't think there's really any debate about who is, you know, the hero as opposed to the lead. And those are two separate things. Because, I mean, the movie goes out of its way in the start to kind of trick you into thinking that he is the big hero. You've got Egg Shen, you know, saying that, you know, everybody owes him a debt and you should leave him alone. The authorities are after him. Everyone talks about him being the savior of Chinatown. And then as the movie goes on, and especially by the time we reach the point where they are infiltrating Lo Pan's stronghold for the first time, you realize that he actually is kind of incompetent. And Wang is the guy who's got all the moves and, you know, is the one actually able to take out the bad guys and has most of the good ideas as well. And Jack Burton really is just kind of along for the ride.
Yeah, and what kind of cements it at the end, so there's this like good kind of bookcase, so I always, or bookends to it, and I always see this as like you can watch it different ways of depending on who you choose to follow. So you can focus on Wang and kind of go through that Joseph Campbell hero's journey aspect of it, where you can see him evolving to, you know, save the love of his life. And there's all these trials and things that he's going through, and he's actually going through those steps from Joseph Campbell's hero's journey. But then you can also look at it as, Jack Burton is coming into town with this kind of air of him, and it gets kind of dispelled and done away with over the course of the movie. But then at the end, you can kind of see how he gets that, because he basically lucks into, you know, killing the final bad guy.
Right, he does kill Lo Pan. No matter how incompetent he is at everything else, he does actually kill the big bad guy at the end. So yeah, that redeems him.
Yeah, and he has the opportunity to, you know, run off with Gracie Law and ride off into the sunset.
God, aren't you even going to kiss her goodbye?
No.
See you around, Burton.
Never can tell.
So it's kind of like this movie and the scene in Little China is the...
It's like him riding back out of town on his horse.
Yeah, and like no one, and what they'll remember is him, you know, defeating Lo Pan. Like, and so you can see how this kind of mythos of Jack Burton emerges. And in this instance, we get this look at like, well, he's not everything that he's meant to be or that people see him as, but you can see how that kind of image has been built up.
Yeah, this is how legends are made.
Yeah, I think it's a very kind of unique character in that sense, where we, in those kind of action movies, every character just keeps building, getting built up more and more and more. And, you know, they're Rambo in a one-man army taking on everybody, you know, and bullets are deflecting off of them. Jack Burton is very human in that sense of that he gets hurt. He screws up a lot. Another character is really the lead and the focus. And, but he's able to kind of capitalize on these points. Not consciously, but he just kind of does the right thing through it. I also think there's like some good nods to the, you know, 80s movie genre and kind of the ridiculousness of it. When they're drinking the magic potion and Wang and Jack have this toast let the wings of liberty never lose a feather. And, yeah. And they do this like long toast to the armed forces. That's the kind of campy 80s movie, action movie stuff that was always out there. And I think like,
well, and then immediately following that up with the bit with them in the elevator, where they're all feeling the effects of the magic potion. And, you know, it is just a straight comedy moment where they're all kind of like, oh, I feel pretty good. Yeah, I feel kind of invincible. Okay. Are you getting hot in here, or is it just me?
I'm feeling positive about this whole thing. Yes. I'm just like, yeah, you're going to go fight a, you know, 1,000-year-old Chinese ghost vampire and, you know, basically three gods of the storm. And they're just kind of having this whole buddy thing of where they consume some kind of Chinese aphrodisiac.
Ecstasy or something.
Yeah, and it's this very odd point.
But that's what I love about Carpenter's movies is that even when he's doing something like this, he can't resist putting in those little odd idiosyncratic bits that are going to turn off the mainstream. You know, there's a lot of his movies have little bits like that that will turn off a lot of mainstream viewers. But for people who like Carpenter and like the way he tells stories, those are the golden bits. Those are the bits that we look forward to.
Yeah, I think that for those of us that really appreciate him, those always get to be the kind of bread and butter, what makes us keep coming back to him over and over again. This movie in particular, I think he has this great kind of mastery of it. And I think it really speaks to the kind of like Hollywood machine as well, that they kind of can't understand it, that they didn't know how to promote this. And they kind of thinking that I I mean, as much as I would want it to be the biggest movie of 86 and beat Top Gun.
There's no way it was ever going to do that.
No, but it could have been this nice, like, cult film that gains this, like, large following from that point if it was done properly. And I can play, you know, armchair studio exec in that sense. But it seems like there was an opportunity of if they would have understood what this is. And I think you actually see that with The Golden Child, the movie that they were trying to beat with it, actually does much, much better, you know, box office wise. I would say that that doesn't have as much of a following, you know, as it does today.
Right. That's not stood the test of time in the way that Big Trouble in Little China has a sort of dedicated cult audience, people like me and you who appreciate it, appreciate the fact that it is quite smart, love Carpenter's movies. Golden Child was obviously a much more financially successful movie, but I remember it with fondness, but I have no desire to sort of drag it out. You know, put it like this, I don't have a DVD of Golden Child sitting on my shelf in my lounge, yeah. You know? I do have the DVD of Big Trouble.
I think I own Blu-ray and DVD of Big Trouble. Because I think one had the commentary, and so I wanted to make sure that I had it on the Blu-ray just to hear that friendship of John Carpenter and Kurt Russell. But
maybe it's the Blu-ray I've got as well then, because I have definitely heard the commentary of this, yeah.
But Golden Child, I watched maybe months ago on Netflix, and it does, like you said, it does not hold up the test of time. I think that they threw a comedy star into an action role and tried to make it mostly an action movie that has these like one-off comedic elements, but Carpenter and Russell are able to kind of fuse action and comedy together almost perfectly.
Right, into a seamless whole, yeah.
Yeah, where it's not forced. So if you look at Golden Child, like where he's in the cave getting the knife and he kind of makes the joke of, I want the knife.
Yeah.
it's like that just...
Which is pretty much the only part of the movie that I actually remember. It was very funny.
I remember that, and the Golden Child makes a Pepsi can dance, and those are pretty the only two things that stick out from that movie. But
right.
I can basically, you know, see the entire Big Trouble landscape in my head.
Well, some of that is bound to be down to the fact that you've watched it so many times. I know with me, that's, you know, certainly the case. But it is also a very quotable movie.
Yes.
So many great lines in it.
Now, this really pisses me off to no end.
It's on the reflexes.
Even right at the start in the airport.
Where'd you get that?
When that guy pulls out that ridiculous telescopic baton.
Son of a bitch must pay.
Shut up, Mr. Button.
All these great, great lines that, through repeated viewing, I don't know, just stick in the mind. And my friends and I, back, you know, when I was in high school and college, we just used to shout those lines at one another constantly. Big Trouble was one of our go-to quotable movies, along with I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker.
That's another hidden gem from my childhood.
Absolutely. Yeah,
But I had the same kind of experience with you of like, you know, this is the movie that if you come over, I'm going to make you watch if you've never seen it with me before. And so many haven't, and I've tried to actively convert people to it, mainly so if we're ever out and, you know, somebody, well, what should we toast to? And, you know, a sick demon bag. And, well, what's in that? You know, wind, fire, and all that stuff. Yeah.
What's in the flask, egg? Magic potion?
Yeah.
Thought so. Good. What do we do, drink it?
Yeah.
Good. I thought so.
It's one of these things of if you just look at it as an entirely fun movie, everything just kind of like catches with you.
Well, this is what I mean about it being a sort of, you have to realize that Burton is the buffoon. I think that's kind of the whole movie is just more enjoyable and makes more sense if you know that, or if you realize that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's if you're watching it thinking that Burton is meant to be the big macho John Wayne style hero, then you probably will be a little underwhelmed. And I think a lot of people were. I think that was part of the problem when it was released. But if you realize that, if you actually realize halfway through, or even know going in, that no, actually he's a buffoon, and you know, it's Wang, this is actually Wang's story and Burton's like an interloper, then yeah, just go along for the ride. And it's such a fun, good-natured, relatively light-hearted movie. Even the serious bits are still pretty light-hearted.
Well, I mean, the final battle takes place in, it's an underground temple, and there's sacrifice.
Grayskull.
And it's literally like a cross between the Temple of Doom with Grayskull in like a discotheque, because
yeah, it's all the neon.
I don't get how that's in the structure of you have you know, guardians that are clearly beholders from Dungeons and Dragons running around. You have gods of death, or lords of death gang members, and storm gods.
The three storm spirits, yeah. And
you have all this stuff, and then somebody's just like, you know what needs to be in here? Just neon. Every place.
Lots of 80s neon.
Yeah. And I think, this might just be me, you know, expressing a lot of fanboyism for John Carpenter, and just kind of his nature of kind of, you know, needling people. And he does have a tendency every now and then to play kind of, I'm smarter than you. And so I have this kind of idea. And I actually think, like, it just strikes me as, like, they meet Lo Pan for the first time, and he's, you know, in his kind of mortal form and, you know, decrepit and bound in the wheelchair. And, you know, Jack Burton's trying to get it. And, you know, Lo Pan's line is, you were not brought on this world to get it. And I think that actually speaks to the movie as a whole, is you're not supposed to get it, you're just supposed to enjoy it, and kind of let it wash over you and just kind of like wade through its goodness.
Yeah, this is not it's almost mocking like white savior action movie tropes.
Yeah,
because, you know, if you look at it on its face, you could see it as a white savior movie. Oh, you know, Jack Burton, the white man, comes into Chinatown, saves the girl, kills the bad guy, rides out again. But as we've said, if you watch it closely, or, you know, sort of just pay attention to what actually happens, it's a real send-up of that stuff. I mean, the bit in the brothel really brings that home, because, again, he's kind of incompetent, and, you know, just, I mean, he's almost like he's mocking himself in that scene, and he doesn't even rescue the girl. He completely fails.
He gets pushed out by the crowd, so there's all these Johns that are in the place that are just shoving him out, and all that he can basically do is he like looks in terror
with the flow,
at lightning coming through. I've always been trying to kind of understand like the kind of cult following of this, and just why it's so was not appreciated. And you're talking about the kind of people missing up the kind of idea that it's, you know, mocking a lot of these kind of like white savior tropes. And there was a big pushback, just in like kind of doing some research for this, from the Asian American community, of them saying like, well, you have this movie about Chinese mythology, it's directed by a white director, the hero is a white actor, and that gets to be the thing of like, no, you don't get the movie.
You haven't watched it, have you?
You've seen the movie poster, which clearly plays into that Edward Said Orientalism, you know, idea. But it's you need to actually kind of understand what you're criticizing in this. I think this is really you know, well crafted and well thought out in that John Carpenter style, like every shot has a purpose to it.
Well, he's a great storyteller. He's a great cinematic storyteller. You know, he doesn't use shaky cam. He doesn't use moving cameras all that often. You know, a lot of his cameras are just locked off, and you get instead of the camera moving with characters, instead you get characters moving through the frame of the picture, which is kind of old fashioned now, but it's nice, and it makes sure that the storytelling is always crystal clear. You know, that's one thing that you can always say about Carpenter, is that you always know exactly what is happening. You may not understand what's happening, but you can always see and tell, you know, what is happening, where people are in a scene. You can follow the action. He's just a great visual storyteller.
Yeah, and he has the other technique. Like, he doesn't use storyboards, and he's never used them, which has become...
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's a very kind of indie director idea. But he's probably the most prolific in utilizing it. And that allows you that freedom of, you know, being able to tell the story. And you have some filmmakers like George Lucas is a very good film, like a very good storyteller. I would say that he's not the greatest of filmmakers when it comes to framing right. some shots and going through that. But having that kind of ability of not locking yourself into a specific shot allows him a lot of mobility and allows him some ability to change that way that he presents things to kind of help the story evolve. That because as you're filming that piece, the story is going to continue to evolve and it's going to take different directions. So he's able to really kind of move with that and have both that storytelling aspect, but also the visual aspects of it as well.
Yeah. And as you say, I mean, that's the sort of thing that comes out of being an indie filmmaker. Gomez, you mentioned sort of the care that he takes over a movie like this. And one of the things that I hadn't watched this movie for a couple of years, and then I rewatched it for the show. And one of the things that struck me, thinking about it sort of more critically, is he clearly is a fan of Hong Kong movies, of Chinese movies, of, you know, the wuxia and the kung fu action and stuff. And this is clearly made with love. Yes, he's a white guy. Yes, he's not part of the culture, but he clearly has an affection for it. I think it's impossible to watch this if you know anything about Chinese and Hong Kong cinema. It's impossible to watch this and not recognize that he clearly has a love of the genre. I mean, was this, you know, it got me thinking, I wonder, was this the first time that most Westerners, certainly most Americans, had seen wuxia wire work? Because you have that scene in the final battle at the end where Wang and, is it Rain, I think, are fighting each other. And they are literally doing wuxia-style wire work, somersaults and, you know, flying through the air while they're clashing swords and stuff. And this was, what, 15 years before Crouching Tiger?
Mm-hmm. And I think that this would be the first kind of like out of the grindhouse experience that Western audiences had exposed to that. So he's way ahead of his time before you see like Crouching Tiger having that and kind of popularizing it. But I this is placed very prominently in it in a lot of dynamics. I think, you know, speaking to like he's a big fan of Hong Kong cinema, I always like to look at it as, I don't know if you ever had it come over to the UK, but the old television show of the Green Hornet, kind of a parallel
yes.
to the Adam West Batman. And, you know, the Green Hornet for American audiences is placed as, you know, the Green Hornet's the hero and, you know, the show never takes off past one season. But in Hong Kong, it's the Kato Show and Bruce Lee's the star. And so I think that he kind of understands that dynamic that's present. And it goes back to that kind of wink, wink tone of like, you know, to a specific kind of smart audience, like, yeah, you and I both know what's really going on here. And he's kind of speaking to that history of, you know, a lot of whitewashing in Western culture and film of these experiences, but really kind of understanding the kind of wonder that comes out of that Hong Kong genre, and really embracing it.
Absolutely. And despite the fact that obviously we have, you know, two white leads in Kurt Russell and Kim Cattrall, you kind of feel that they, you know, you had to do that. Unfortunately, in the 80s, it was still a time where you, and some people would argue that we still are in that time, where you simply couldn't sell a movie like this with an Asian lead. But I will note that just about every other actor in the movie is Asian. You know, they have not filled it with white guys who look, you know, a bit Asian or whatever, or even white guys who don't even pretend to be Asian. This is full of Asian actors. And that alone makes it stand out amongst American martial arts movies.
Yeah, there's only three white actors in the entire thing, if I'm correct. It's Kim Cattrall and Kurt Russell and Margot are the the only ones. And really, all of them play that kind of buffoon that Jack Burton plays as well. Like, you know, Kim Cattrall's, you know, Gracie has this kind of like air of superiority through her.
Right, they're all the interfering outsider.
Yeah, of like where she, like they're like, don't go near her, Jack, she's a lawyer. And she like just comes in and like, Gracie Law is here. And she kind of presents this self-importance, but, you know, she ends up just being snatched by a demon and, you know, kidnapped like everybody else and kind of becomes interchangeable. So she doesn't have that prominence. And Margot is, you know, that kind of journalist that I think they kind of mock her and that kind of journalist archetype. I'll do anything for the story.
Well, and that she thinks she's much more important than she really is.
Yeah.
Like nobody else cares about the fact that she's a reporter for some local newspaper.
Yeah. And basically all that, and they even kind of like push her to get her away. It's like, we need you here to stay with Eddie because Eddie has a crush on you. And they kind of just like push her to the side of, you know, you're not important to this. Please stay away and don't touch anything because you might break it. and it's great because even like Eddie, who's Wang's partner and kind of the like suave maitre d', is, you could say, is like more masculine than and more prominent than Jack Burton. Like when they go through their first thing to free the kidnapped girls, and to get Gracie and Margot freed from the Wing Kong exchange, you know, he ends up doing the fighting.
Right, it's Eddie who stands alongside Wang and actually takes out the sort of ninja women guard type people.
Yeah, with their weird kind of like hallucinogenic smoke sticks. again, like another like little Hong Kong like trait of, like, if you start looking at the weapons, they do have this kind of like Hong Kong cinema feel of, going back to that alleyway scene, they have the kind of poles holding the casket, and those just happen to be like collapsible, like bow staffs
yeah.
that they end up pulling out. And it, when they first introduced the three storms of what is it? Thunder has the full moon kind of daggers, and I think it's Rain that has the claws,
tiger claws. Yeah,
yeah, and then Lightning has these kind of like spinning blades on his hands.
Yeah, like ring attached. Yeah, and they just start whirring. What the hell is that?
And and
what's powering them? There's no battery pack.
But he's Lightning, right? So he would be able to power them himself. Like he's basically Raiden from Mortal Kombat, who's like the like probably the greatest legacy of this is clearly on a mass market, right? Somebody up in the higher echelons really of the kind of video game world really loves this because, you know, Lightning is Raiden in Mortal Kombat. Like they've basically just captured that character. There are these kind of like nuances that are carried on in the larger culture that can trace back to this. And I just think, again, to like go back to the kind of idea of these Hong Kong parallels, that the kind of elaborate fight scene has these kind of like very choreographed one-on-one battles is another thing that eventually gets carried on into the larger scope, you know, from this. And I think, you know, not to say that this is the main influencer, but I think Carpenter and realizes a trend that's going to emerge, and he's just a little bit too early to the whole dance that's there.
Right. Once again, he's ahead of his time.
Yeah. And so like the big battle fight scene, this kind of idea that you have, you know, Egg Shen and Lo Pan squaring off, and then Wang and Rain, and, you know, these even individual, you know, gang member fights that are occurring instead of this kind of big mass battle sequence where it's one person fighting everybody. I think he just, you know, beats the punch a little bit into that. And then can we talk about real quick? I always have this question about when Egg Shen and Lo Pan are facing off again, and they have the kind of like magic that emerges as a battle between two warriors in the magic.
Right, like a spirit battle, yeah.
I just totally can't figure that out for the entire time. It just seems like too much effort that if you're meeting your worst enemy, that this is how you decide to play it out, is that you each manifest like a Green Lantern, you know, your individual like constructs to do battle instead of like direct, clearly they have the capabilities to directly fight each other and they choose this method, but it also has the hand gesture with like Lo Pan, the way that he amps his powers by wiggling his pinkies.
Well, and his thumbs, almost like he's playing like a video game console. I have always just assumed that that part is somewhere rooted in, you know, a real part somewhere of Chinese folklore. And that it's a kind of, well, this is how wizards fight sort of thing. I don't know that, but that's what I've always assumed. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they just thought it would be cool. But you're right. It does seem a lot of effort to go to.
Yeah, and there are some of those Chinese folklore mythology, like Taoist and Buddhist mythology trends to there, right? With like all the hells, like...
The hell of being skinned alive and the hell of the upside down sinners.
Which is actually a hell. Like, that is a legitimate...
Oh, really?
It goes by a different name. I'll have to look it up. But there is a legitimate one that when you go through the descriptor, it is that you're hung upside down underwater. And if you go through it, depending on like what you're looking at, you know, there'll be like 18 hells or 12,000 or 84,000. Like,
well, sure, it was a war. And anybody that showed up was going to join Lemley in the hell of being cut to pieces.
Hell of being what?
Chinese have a lot of hells.
I recently, you know, they relaunched kind of the sequel in comic book form. And, you know, John Carpenter is working with that. And it's actually, you know, carries on kind of the themes of Big Trouble very well. But they still make the joke like Lo Pan's in the hell of people that are killed by idiots.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, and all these trends of like what are they, you know, like the black blood of the earth and the bog of dead trees, like those actually appear in Chinese mythology. So it's again like Carpenter is really kind of putting a lot of effort into this, and some of the things that might seem mocking are actually really endorsing the kind of idea, and shows his kind of like care that he's putting into this.
Right. Again, yeah, his love for, you know, that folklore and Chinese cinema. I mean, let's be honest, this is not a perfect movie by any means. And
no.
There are some bits where, you know, you think, oh, you know, a little bit more care and attention on the sets or something might have worked wonders there, or Carpenter's, you know, regular sort of distaste for overly lighting things. Actually, there's a few elements in this movie that could have done with a little more lighting and a little more art to the cinematography. But one thing that it does have in its favor is its pace. One of the things I really noticed this when I was watching it again back in preparation for this show is it's a fast movie. I mean, it's a good length. It's like an hour 35, hour 40 minutes. It just never lets up.
Mm-hmm.
It's right from the start. You're barely 10 minutes in and you've got the scene at the airport with like a skirmish and a kidnapping and nearly getting run over by a car. A few minutes later, there's the massive showdown between the Changsings and the Wing Kong. You've got a full-on firefight followed by a big martial arts battle. And it just keeps that pace up throughout pretty much the whole movie. There is so much going on that you just get swept along in it. And it never really lets up. So as you said before, if you just kind of let yourself be taken along for the ride and have fun, then, you know, this movie, one of the things it will never do is bore you.
Yeah, and I think going with that structure is there's very little kind of like expository nature to it. Like what's there is like when they have the, like they're back in the restaurant, in Wang's restaurant, going through... you know, Burton's on with his insurance company, and kind of like half-heartedly he's learning about the history of China. Like he's kind of like half listening to understanding about these gang wars and Lo Pan and who all these people are. And then after they come back before the kind of final approach, they have kind of like another little bit of that.
But there's one thing even David Lo Pan must acknowledge. All movement in the universe is caused by tension between positive and negative furies.
So when the furies are out of balance,
as they are in Lo Pan, who is cursed,
then the people turn into demon and live forever.
Repulsive and evil, existing only to plague the living.
Well, then, I mean, what you're saying is this David Lo Pan, what is he, a ghost?
He plays at being a man, creature of vast dark, destructive power.
But most of it is learned through just like quick little bits. And part of me wants a little bit more elaboration on some things, but I can also appreciate that you're able to build kind of your own assumptions. But just as a viewer, to go back like kind of a weak point, like I want a little bit more of elaboration to just some of the, really it gets to be like history of Lopan. Like, you know, they talk about being cursed by the first emperor and having to sacrifice a woman with green eyes to this demon. And, you know, like I was watching it again with my wife, and that was like her main question, was that she saw Lopan in the alley and she was questioning, well, why is light coming out of his eyes and mouth? And then the next thing she was like, well, who's this guy in the wheelchair? And well, that's Lopan. And it takes a couple of viewings to kind of draw the whole picture together, where I think there would have been a little bit of break of, you know, taking just a quick step to do a little bit more exposition, not to heavily do it. I think that, it's a really well-paced movie, but there could have been a little bit more inserted, and that might just be me of, you know, being a Western viewer, and it's muddled by decades of watching this.
I, on the one hand, I agree, because I think that's probably one of the things that held it back from being more of a success with mainstream audiences, is that they do gloss over a lot of stuff. But on the other hand, I selfishly, again, I do kind of quite like that, because, for example, it's really heavily implied that Egg Shen is also some kind of immortal sorcerer, and that him and Lopan have been battling, you know, down the centuries against one another. But it's never actually outright said. You know, that is never stated explicitly. It's just kind of heavily implied, and then you're left to make that assumption for yourself. And I really like that. I like that kind of respect for the audience's intelligence, you know?
Yeah, and I can see that and actually really like it. I think that there's a tendency, you know, with the kind of mainstream audience that, well, especially nowadays, you want the big epic that can draw in, you know, $500 million, $1 billion. Or you want to make something really, really cheap that just blows away the idea of the box office, right? And makes, you know, 10 times what its budget was.
Right. Even if it only makes 10 million, that's still 10 times what it cost.
Yeah. And you want the option to do sequels, right? Of over and over and over again. And I think that this is a movie that, like, if I believe that there's talk of a remake now, which actually kind of terrifies me, because The Rock is the one that owns the rights now. And I think that that would skew very much towards an action-centered movie.
Maybe? Yeah.
He has that kind of comedic tone, but I think the kind of the way to do this would be very low-budget, kind of go through the same ways, maybe correct it. I would like it, if you're going to make it, to make it more of a sequel set in the world, kind of like a blood relative. Instead of something that is The Rock coming in to play Jack Burton, kind of dynamic. And you can have kind of like Mad Max is the same character, the Fury Road, but you can still, from a kind of new audience perspective, you can kind of, you know, remove yourself from that a little bit and just kind of live in that world.
Right.
So I think there's a way to properly do it.
Well, and it's not a direct remake. Fury Road was not an actual remake of like any of the other three Mad Max movies.
Yeah, and I think it's a sign that they're just trying to capitalize on a cult following, because sadly, I'll probably still watch it just out of curiosity, so they'll get my $850.
I don't know. If neither Carpenter nor Kurt Russell's involved, I'm just not sure why I would be interested, you know? I mean, and I like The Rock, don't get me wrong. I think he's good. I enjoy him in the Fast and Furious movies. I've seen him in a couple of comedies, and he's been good as well. But if Carpenter and Russell are not involved, like, you know, and certainly I don't imagine that James Hong is going to come back to play Lupin. So, you know, he wouldn't need the makeup, would he? What's the attraction?
So, yeah, crazy, like, parallel was I met Lopan at, like, a Wizard Con years ago. And, like, he still, like, has aged perfectly to look like he's still looking like he does in Lopan without the whitewash makeup. So, like, ghost Lopan.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he's aged very well, like, for in that dynamic. So I think that you could drop him, like, actually pretty well into it. But also, like, one of the nicest guys ever who plays such a, like, a great villain.
Right, yeah.
But on a remake, I don't think that there's any need for it if Carpenter, like you said, if Carpenter or Russell isn't involved to kind of nurture it the way that it needs to be done. And I'm a big proponent in the idea that, you know, there are some things that don't need sequels and they don't need remakes and they can just right. live in their own time and place. And I would say that this is one of them. It's really kind of caught cult lightning in a bottle, and it's going to be very difficult to replicate that.
Yeah, especially that kind of, it did really catch that 80s feel for one thing. Then again, it's always dangerous for Carpenter fans to say, oh no, you shouldn't remake something, because of course, one of Carpenter's, you know, most successful, most famous movies is The Thing, which is a remake. But I think that's one of the reasons that it's successful is because it's so different. You know, I don't know if you've seen the original of The Thing from Outer Space, but, you know, Carpenter's The Thing is really just took the very, very basic high premise, and then everything else is completely different. And if they made a new Big Trouble where they did that, where they literally just took the idea, okay, Jack Burton rides into town, gets him way over his head in, you know, involved in some sort of Chinese mythology adventure, and then changed everything else to make it feel more like a modern movie, maybe that could work. Maybe then I'd be more interested.
True. And, like, I think that to talk with what you were saying about The Thing, if you look at the prequel thing that they came out with a few years ago.
I haven't seen that.
Actually try to fuse the original and John Carpenter's in the sense of,
oh, wow.
Like it has that John Carpenter mythos, but in the kind of dynamics of the original movie, there's actually some shots that are copied, you know, pretty much frame for frame. And I want to say that that's more of a homage than an admiration for the original, and try to give it its due, because
I would certainly hope so.
Yeah, not a lot of people understand that, you know, Carpenter's is a remake.
Well, that's the other thing, is most people just don't even know that the original exists, do they?
Yeah, and I think that speaks to the fact that just the original thing, or John Carpenter's thing, is so different from the original one.
Yeah.
You know, and it stands on its own because of, you know, all the amazing special effects work that's in that movie. And the just different premise that it takes. So it can kind of, you know, be similar in rights and title and things like that, but it like really Carpenter pulls it out and makes it its own. So I think if you're going to do it, I would agree with you that if you're going to do it right, you need to kind of take a similar approach to it. Probably the person that you'd want to have as a consultant on that film then would be John Carpenter, to kind of help you lay it out how you would do it. And I'm thinking that he's probably not interested.
I would be very, very surprised if he's interested in that. I mean, by all accounts, his involvement with, was it the Rob Zombie relaunch of Halloween? He was a consultant on, and I think it was that movie, or if it wasn't that, maybe it was H2O or one of the Halloweens anyway. And he said that his involvement was basically to walk on the set, smile and go, yeah, looks great, and then go home and collect his check. You know, he really just wasn't interested in actually being involved unless he could be genuinely involved. And I can appreciate that. You know, I think that's understandable, that it would be very difficult to watch somebody else effectively remake something that you already made, and then expect you to sort of give them advice on it, except that they're not doing it the way you would have done. That's got to be a really difficult position to be in.
Yeah, and I think that there's something about that that's kind of like unsaid, that when you do, you know, remake something, you know, as like an artist and a creator, what you want to do is create something that's timeless, right? That continues to live. And a sequel basically says, well, you didn't finish it, so it needs to continue going. And then a remake basically says, well, you did it right for a time period, or, you didn't do it right at all.
But it doesn't hold up anymore, yeah.
And it doesn't hold up anymore. And so I think this still holds up. I mean, you can go watch it on Netflix right now. And I think that it's found a kind of second generation audience because it almost has like a permanent home on, you know, instant streaming now. And I think that there could be that level of kind of like remorse of having to go on it. I don't know. It would have to kind of go and tell your ex-wife's new boyfriend, like, what's the best way to romance her on Valentine's Day?
Right. Who wants to do that?
Yeah, it's like the most insulting thing. And plus, we're going to pay you for it. So, I mean, you can't feel that great about yourself on top of it, that you're, you know, coming back to basically, you know, really corrupt
all the money.
And it sounds like,
and for somebody like Carpenter, who started out in the indie world, like, I think for many filmmakers that wouldn't be an issue, but for somebody like Carpenter, who made his name making indie movies, and even when he was making mainstream movies, clearly had a big indie ethos, that is kind of that would be a really difficult position for him. And I think, yeah, the fact that he'd be, oh, but we'll offer you loads of money, it was like, that kind of makes it worse.
that is even worse to him. I think that even if you look at his most recent stuff that hasn't, you know, been as critically well received, and I actually, you know, think that other pieces of his have been unjustly maligned, but I think that he's just a storyteller that has stories that he wants to put out there and tries to do it. And I think he's, you know, he remade The Thing as kind of his own. You know, he made Christine, which is based on the Stephen King story, but he really makes that, takes elements of that and makes his own as well. But it has good parallels, so it shows that he can also respect good stories,
right?
But then if you look at even kind of Escape from LA, the sequel to Escape from New York, which isn't as timeless as Big Trouble, in my opinion, but I think still has its good points. He clearly has a vision of what he wants to tell. He's critiquing the West Coast culture in that sense.
I think Escape from LA is one of those. I mean, that could be a candidate for this show, frankly. It's, you know, no, it's not as good as Escape from New York, but then what is? You know, what is, really?
Yeah.
But it is much, much better than a lot of people, you know, sort of remember it as. It got really, really panned at the time, and I always thought that was very unfair.
Yeah, and I remember, I think it was, like, we got HBO for, you know, like, a free week or something like that. So, free paid cable, and they had, like, the first look, like, the preview to it. And I was enamored with that as well, because you can kind of see, oh, yeah, he's got an idea to just kind of, like, mock things. So, and he's picking apart, you know, Beverly Hills plastic surgery culture and the kind of like materialistic sports nature that was in the West Coast at the time, and
California centrism as well.
Yeah. And I just love the fact of like the ignoring the kind of like acid rain qualities, and he's pointing out that, you know, the kind of like larger ecosystem of California isn't necessarily all that good, and then years later he's proven right, and we have a massive California drought. And so it's this great, he's I think, you know, those that love him really love him, and this is one of the kind of tent poles of that affection. And I think you have to just approach his films with a very kind of like open mind, and just kind of like let yourself walk through his world that he's trying to create, and start to look at it at multiple angles instead of just that kind of direct, you know, box office, you know, smash hit that a lot of people go into.
Yeah. Well, and he really did create a world with this movie that I think the world does kind of stand the test of time. Like, yes, as I say, you look at it now and the film looks very 80s, obviously, but the overall story and the mythology and the sort of the little details of the mythology and the world building in it absolutely stand up. I still, as I say, I hadn't watched it for a couple of years, but I watched it many, many times when I was younger, and then did watch it again in prep for the show. And again, once again, really enjoyed it. Found myself laughing out loud at some of the better lines, and, you know, being enthralled and really enjoying the performances by pretty much all of the actors. I don't think there was a bad performance in it, really. So I'm absolutely 100% with you that this film is completely unjustly maligned.
Yeah, it really is underappreciated in that aspect. And a lot of like kind of the 80s, you know, cheese that's soaked onto it of like, you know, Kurt Russell's haircut and the like
the neon.
Yeah, the neon and those like leather sleeve bomber jackets that were a thing for a while.
Oh yeah.
those are all kind of like you can pull yourself out of those and those just become kind of this kind of quaint eccentricity.
That's like how everybody's wearing zoot suits in a 1940s movie or something. It's like, you know, you just go with it.
Yeah, you just kind of embrace it, right? And if you at one point in time that stuff, you know, fades away and you don't really draw attention to it anymore.
All right. That is a good place, I think, to bring this to a close. Michael, thank you very much for coming on the show. Where can people find you if they like what you have to say?
I'm on Twitter at Code Red Palmer. It's mostly movies and comments on pro wrestling. So, and every now and then you get some little technology wonder to it, but it's this conversation just in 140 characters or less.
Thanks for listening to Unjustly Maligned. I hope you enjoyed it. And if you did, please check out my comics, books, and music. Go to anthonyjohnston.com where you'll find information and links to all of my work. Please also consider rating Unjustly Maligned on iTunes. It's the best way to spread the word about the show and is very much appreciated. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable and is made in England. You can find more information, links and show notes at ump.fm. Thanks for listening and we'll see you next time. Fantasy creatures like the Beholder, as you mentioned, which is clearly just a Beholder from D&D. Why on earth is that even there? And the big hairy creature that snatches Gracie Law and then does the Michael Myers and you know, sort of reappears on Jack Burton's truck at the end. Like, why are they even there? There's no reference to them in any of the mythology exposition. Their parts could easily be taken by one of the storms or a henchman or something. Other than wanting to show off the creature effects, I just don't understand why they're in the movie.
And I think that's what it is John Carpenter, you know, makes the thing after the or before this. And I think he wants to show off that kind of creature effect of it. I mean, they are very well put together, you know, special effects, you know,
creatures. They're well made. Absolutely. Especially for 86.
But,
yeah.
But I totally agree with you of what the kind of like orangutan demon, just like... He just appear, because I think the way they introduce him is he's the one that snatches Gracie and you just see his eyes and his kind of like arm, and then there's this monstrous, you know, gaping maw of a mouth like grabbing her, and they never touch on her. Now in the comics that have followed, I literally just started reading them this week, and they actually make a point that, oh, that's his pet demon that is tied to Lopan, and the reason he's on the truck is because now he's tied to Jack because Jack killed Lopan, so the bond passes over. But well,
that makes him more like Chewbacca than an enemy.
he's like a large demonic monkey puppy, like in that kind of sense. And he's the main confusion because he only is there for snatching Gracie Law, and I can't remember if he's in the big fight sequence or not. If he is,
I think he appears, but then he gets taken out by one of Egg Shen's little, you know, pearl grenades.
Yeah, and then he appears on the truck. And then the Beholder is like, they kind of say like, oh, that's a guardian where what he sees Lopan sees. And it makes it to the point that Lopan doesn't even care, right? Because they kind of have this dialogue of Egg Shen and Lopan through the Guardian, through the like floating beholder demon, and Lopan really just brushes them off. And then when they get out of the elevator, the Guardian's right there, and yeah, they continue to just go with the wedding. So that's even a character that you can, or an element that you can just remove entirely, in my opinion.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, if you wanted to substitute, if you really, really wanted to have that, you know, you could have a guard that Lopan possesses and speaks through or something. But as you say, you don't really even need that sequence at all, because it doesn't change anything about Lopan's plan.
Yeah, and I think it's really just he wants to do a little bit of show off of he wants to show those kind of creature effects on what's there. And I'm trying to find real quick who the guy is that does the creature effects. Because there's some parallels. If it's John Lloyd, he's, there are some carryovers from The Thing, and it I can't find it quickly now, but, it might just be he wants to pay homage to people that have done really good work for him.
Right. It was done by a company called Boss Studios, headed up by a guy called Richard Edlund, apparently.
Yeah.
Who is an award-winning, multiple Academy Award-winning U.S. special effects cinematographer, according to Wikipedia, which is never wrong.
And it might just be the fact, you know, I think this is like his, up until the time, this is like his second largest budget of $20 million. And right. He might just be
they did the visual effects for Ghostbusters, which are very good. So, you know.
And those also hold up, I think.
Absolutely,
so
yeah.
I think this might just be, those might be inserts from the studio, and those might be, because in anything I've ever heard Carpenter do, he's never spoken to them. And they're so kind of encapsulated in the way that they're shot, is there's very minimal interaction, especially with that beholder. Is that my thought is maybe the studio is just like, you know what, we need some more special effects into it. And he crams it in, because the opening scene with Jack Burton on the radio, that's put in to make Burton seem more heroic, to kind of push that idea of Burton's the hero. And the line in the alleyway, it's one of those things like the line in the alleyway. So this is a movie where Carpenter just clashes with the studio on, and they have their finger, not just like their finger in the pie, but they're like punching it and splattering filling all over the place.
Like you, I am a big, big Carpenter fan. Escape from New York is literally one of my favorite movies, like, of all time. I absolutely love that movie. And of course it has, you know, some of the same problems as this does, in that it's obviously low budget and you can tell, and there are sort of a couple of bits where you go, why is that there? But overall, I just absolutely love that movie. But over the years, one of the things I've noticed, and see whether you agree, because frankly, I don't know that many other big John Carpenter fans. So let me posit this theory to you. I think that he seems to work best, or seems to do his best work, when telling stories with a very simple premise, a sort of simple, compelling high concept, like Escape from New York. New York is a prison, and the president is trapped inside. The Thing, alien, can assume human form, attacks an isolated Antarctic base. Halloween, supernatural psychopath stalks a young girl. You know, very, very simple. And as soon as you hear this premise, you're like, oh, okay, that's interesting. But then you look at his less successful films, and I'm by that I mean less financially successful, like this, or They Live, or In the Mouth of Madness, which are all great movies. In the Mouth of Madness especially is another one of my absolute favorites of his, but it is very difficult to sum up the premise of all of those movies in a way that sounds immediately compelling. Do you see what I mean? Like, it's very hard to sum up Big Trouble in Little China quickly and still make it sound exciting. And I think that seems to be where he struggles.
And I agree with you on that. So, like, with you and In the Mouth of Madness, I'm a huge They Live fan. And that might be the pro wrestling connection of Roddy Piper. and again, I think it's a movie that's very quotable and has, you know, that amazing alley fight scene. But
yeah, well, and the classic line, I'm here to kick ass and chew bubblegum, and I'm all out of bubblegum. I mean, that has just entered the popular lexicon.
Yeah, that's carried over, and I'm surprised how few people understand where that comes from. But I agree with you, because you have to give this kind of like explanation of like, well, aliens have come and they've instilled us with capitalism, and they're making us buy things to keep us passive so that they can take advantage of all our fun resources and have sex with our women. And the only way that you can see them is these sunglasses, and they give you a headache if you like. There's all this, convoluted nature to it. And then if you even look at like some of his more recurrent works, like Vampires, he's trying to create this really big world and kind of change the dynamic of our current state, but it really gets kind of like lost in translation. I don't think Vampires is anything somebody should run out and try to go or really cross your fingers that Netflix has.
Sadly not.
Yeah.
No. Well, and even Prince of Darkness was, which again is a good movie, not as good as stuff like In the Mouth of Madness, but it's good. But the premise, like trying to explain the premise, you've got this green liquid and it's really the devil. And, it's like, what?
That was
what's going on here?
That's been a couple of conversations with people of where, because I'm a fan of that whole, apocalypse trilogy that he tries to bring. My favorite out of them is The Thing. But yeah, trying to explain the Prince of Darkness to people is a little difficult at times. But I would even say, the fact like, and you can kind of see where he teeters a little bit. I think Christine falls into one of those other movies of where he's able to do it on a very simple premise, possess car. Right. But it's also, it adds another layer where it's also changing the behavior of the driver. And so it gets to be a little muddled in that instance. So it's not as good as it could be, but I really agree with you that he needs to stay laser-like focused on the kind of idea that he's trying to convey. Instead of drawing a big web, he just tells a linear story.
Right.
Which, like,
tell a simple story, but tell it really well, which he is very good at doing.
It's been a while since I've seen In the Mouth of Madness. So I'll have to go back and visit that one.
I haven't watched it for a few years, but I have seen it several times, and it's it doesn't make much more sense on repeated viewings, but I still love it all the same. It is one of those movies that this is what I was, the kind of thing that I was talking about earlier, where, there is so much in The Mouth of Madness that is not explained, or not explicitly explained, but just kind of hinted at. And I love it. And that's one of the reasons why you can watch it again and again.
Have you ever seen Assault on, his version of Assault on Precinct 13?
Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah, I think that's another one of those where it's very simple concept.
Oh, that's such a cheap movie. My God, yeah. That movie cost like, $50 and a bottle of whiskey to the cameraman. I mean, it's so
but
cheap.
And it's totally in my love of like these kind of like cheap, almost trauma-esque movies.
Right, that's a good comparison.
Yeah, yeah. Where it's you're just trying to get your name out of there and you're trying to kind of create that. I think the budget for that one, like, I think they say $100,000, but there's no way that that can be $100,000.
No, more like $100.
Yeah, like in 1976, I'm assuming that he like paid for a lot of that with change that he found in a parking lot, and it was like he filled up like a mayonnaise jar with quarters and was like, I think I have enough to make a movie now. I'll tell you, it's a sign that I married a good woman when she's willing to watch Big Trouble with Me like three times this week.